thebridgeproject.org. You can also check out past shows, subscribe to our weekly podcast, and make a difference by supporting our work. If today's show raised questions for you, share the show with a friend. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is making_contact. Special thanks to Fantastic Negrito and the entire Black Ball Universe crew. Today's show was produced by Eric Arnold, Anita Johnson, and Marichi. The Making Contact team also includes Lisa Rudman, RJ Lozada, Monica Lopez, Vera Tykoska, and Sabine Blazon. I'm Eric Arnold. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
Cable Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the film screening of Living While Dying on Tuesday, November 28th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Everything you wanted to know about conscious dying but were afraid to ask, Living While Dying is a documentary film exploring how different people are preparing for death and reevaluating their relationship to dying. Again, that's Living While Dying on Tuesday, November 28th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to Voices for the Animals on your community radio, KBOO Portland.
The more compassion we have towards animals, the more compassion we're going to have towards other people.
If you can value them all, you really value yourself as well.
So even if you don't care about animals, the things we do that hurt animals end up hurting ourselves.
It's almost kind of a dominion type issue where we feel we need to control everything.
Dominion means stewardship, to take care of.
What would a cow think about satisfying our habit? The challenge lies with looking at suffering from the perspective of the person or individual suffering.
Welcome to Voices for the Animals. This is Dab Stedman, and for today, I'm passing the microphone over to another KBOO radio host, Ender Black. Ender?
Hi. Hi, Dab. Hi. It's a great pleasure and honor to be here as, guest host for this episode of Voices for the Animals. And audience, dear KBOO audience, today we have here in this production room one of my personal heroes. She manages a squirrel sanctuary refuge, basically a facility for squirrels in the area, and it's just a wonderful thing. So before we start by finding out who this person is, what about if you share with us right now, what is the most beautiful experience you've had with a squirrel?
I would have to say that the very first time that I released squirrels that had been brought to me as a wildlife rehabilitator to care for them, and they ran up the tree and were free outside of these release environments. And that was probably the most joyful moment to me, the very first time that I actually went through a release.
Okay, so share with us. Tell us who you are, your name, and what you do.
Okay, I'm Jackie Marsden, and I founded Squirrel Refuge over in Vancouver, Washington. It is the only wildlife facility and service available in all of Southwest Washington. And we actually end up doing more than just squirrels. All wildlife has to come to us because in both Washington and Oregon, as the laws are, if a wildlife rehabilitator does not take an animal, it has to be euthanized by law.
Okay. Tell us when and where all this journey of yours start.
Well, just like what seems to happen to hundreds of people every year, I found a baby squirrel, and I tried to find help for it. And in Washington, there were absolutely no wildlife rehabilitators that would take the squirrel, even if I was willing to drive all the way to Seattle, just because during baby season, all of the centers fill up very quickly. And in Oregon, they don't allow wildlife rehabilitation of urban wildlife, such as squirrels, rabbits, and possums. So I was left with this problem. And just like anybody who wants to get involved, I decided, well, I should be part of the solution. And so I went through a very long process of getting licensed with the state of Washington. And I started the nonprofit so that I could get other volunteers in and funding. In both Washington and Oregon, there is no funding.
KABU Community Radio
for,
holds open meetings concerning
that,
the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934.
It's a challenge all the way around. And so, you know, by starting that nonprofit, I was able to filter some of that funding over to wildlife centers here in Oregon and in Washington.
Okay, guys, I got to tell you, I met
Jackie Marsden.
Yes. And I met her because I had the blessing of having a baby squirrel come to my life. The baby squirrel fell somehow in our attic in our house, and it fell on the floor, and somebody found it. Nobody was able to do anything with it. So it was my first time. I've always been an animal lover, so it doesn't, you know, it wasn't too hard for me to think about the squirrel. So I rehabbed the squirrel. It changed my life. I'm just going to summarize it by that. It was one of the most rewarding experiences I've ever had and really changed my views. And it came the time when I had to transfer the squirrel to a place where it would be safe for a variety of reasons. So I met her, and I wonder, and I want the audience to know, what does it take to run such a facility, a place for squirrels? In our culture that, you know, it doesn't really, it's not something that is part of our culture to have sanctuaries for animals in general.
Well, it takes a lot of energy. I'll tell you that much right now. I've had 2,500 squirrels come through my care. And when I found out I was the only rehabilitator in the county and that animals would be euthanized if I didn't take them, that opened me up to taking other wildlife and doing a lot of driving and transferring wildlife that I'm not licensed to care for to facilities that can care for them. It also takes a great deal to educate yourself, because if you're going to take this on, you have to do right by the animals. And that means knowing how to deal with their medical issues, understanding their behaviors. I mean, I have put in so much effort to become an expert about squirrels, rabbits, and possums, because those are the most frequent animals I see, and to understand their psychology and make sure that I'm giving them the best care that I can. It also takes a lot of money, just in terms of the formula. There are formulas made for squirrels, rabbits, and possums, and so I want to make sure they're getting the best nutrition while they're in my care. So I work with a lot of people. When I first started out, it was just me, but now there's about 40 people, and they are ready and willing at any point to step in and help care for these animals. So it takes a skills across multiple areas. You have to be able to manage your volunteers. You have to be knowledgeable. At this point, I have several sub-permittees that are getting licensed in Washington, and so right now the effort's not nearly as much as it is. As it was when I first started, because it was just me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In your view, why are squirrels valuable? Because I think this question wouldn't be too easy for a lot of people. Like, mm-hmm. I'm completely biased. I just think they're beautiful. And they're just beautiful beings that just enhance my life personally, just every time I see them up mm-hmm. and down the trees. They're like tree spirits to me. So tell us, why are squirrels valuable?
Well, from somebody like you who's had a relationship with a squirrel, they are amazingly sweet animals. And really, they don't bite out of aggression necessarily. They have reasons for behaving the way that they do. But for the average person to understand why squirrels are so important, there are many ways to view it. First of all, they're a keystone species. If there's something going on with the squirrel population, because we don't see wildlife every day, we start noticing if all the squirrels are gone or if they're coming up with diseases or issues. So that's one thing, is that they do act as a barometer to our wildlife. And it's also that most people don't see wildlife. You don't see the bears and the cougars and the wolves. And, you know, a lot of Oregon and Washington's native wildlife don't really like people. But when you have squirrels like people, especially these urban squirrels. Now, the native squirrels in Oregon don't really like people at all, and so you very rarely see them. But the urban squirrels, the eastern gray squirrels and the fox squirrels, they love people, and they give us an opportunity to witness nature right up front. And then lastly, their value to our native wildlife in both Washington and Oregon cannot be overlooked. They're often, you'll hear people say, well, these are non-native animals and we shouldn't have them here. But because they've had established populations for over 100 years, our native wildlife relies on them as a source of food, which I know we don't like as rehabilitators. You know, we put in all this effort, maybe weeks and or months, and then some bird of prey comes along and eats them. But that is their place in nature, and nature always remains in balance. So these squirrels are here, and they are supporting our native wildlife, and they're giving to society a great gift of allowing us to witness nature in action right there in front of us.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I've read, well, I'm a student, so I've had to read a lot and learn a lot about stuff and history. Mm-hmm. And I know the past 100 years in our culture, in American culture, there has been this unconscious, in my view, movement that kind of separates people from nature. So nature just becomes secondary, even third place, like completely not important at all. But I see this change happening, like people becoming more sensitive to animals, being more and more polite when it comes to people that care about animals. So do you see a bright future for the world? So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely I do. I think, I mean, squirrels make me happy. They just do. When I see squirrels out playing, I think that's a beautiful thing, and that makes me very happy to see that. When I see squirrels in a neighborhood, that's a sign of a healthy neighborhood. You know, you won't see squirrels in places where there aren't a lot of trees or where the environment's not healthy. So, yeah, the more squirrels that are around, really, the more bountiful your environment is. Again, that's why I view them as a keystone species. So, yes, I think the more human beings start showing compassion to their fellow animals, I think that tells me that we have a bright future. It's when people disregard these animals or think of them as unimportant. Early on, as a wildlife rehabilitator, I worked with a man, and he said to me, well, there's just so many squirrels. Why does it matter? As wildlife rehabilitators, we care about the individual. The Department of Fish and Wildlife, they're looking at larger ecological issues, and they look at populations. We deal with the individual itself. That individual animal is important to us. And we, you know, yeah, we might take a squirrel with a broken leg to a vet, and that vet is going to spend time pinning it together and healing. And we're, you know, people will say, why are you doing that? Well, because that individual animal's life is important. And when people care, that expands our humanity. So, yeah, I think we have a bright future.
I have another question that I think might be a little weird. I apologize. But why do you think, it seems to me that the majority of people believe that humans are superior to animals. Mm-hmm. What do you think that's the case? And why would they think that?
Well, I think in many ways, the cost of us thinking of animals as not being inferior is pretty great. We would have to stop factory farming. You know, we would have to start making some pretty big choices if we acknowledged what goes on to animals so that we can eat them or wear them. Or, you know, if we start looking at animals as having feelings and that they can suffer, then we have to make choices. And it's just a lot easier to just think they're not important so that we don't have to make those changes.
Yes, I have this hypothetical scenario. Somebody from the Department of Education asks you, like, okay, so we have all this funding for trying to teach high school kids or middle school kids the value of the wildlife around them. Like, what would be kind of like, if you can think of something really quickly, like one, two, or three points that you would add to that, like what to do directly to teach young people the value of the wildlife around them?
Right. Well, the first thing, if you can get young people involved in caring about animals early on, I mean, let's face it, you're going to have a healthier individual than one who does not value or you know, if you look at most sociopaths, they start with animals. And so that's kind of a key indicator of a problem of that individual needs some help. So if I were going to put a curriculum together to sort of get young people involved early on, you know, building a feeder, building a squirrel house or a bird house or a bat house, anything that gets kids involved with, you know, sort of their backyard wildlife and get them excited about seeing these animals come and live there. You know, once you get children involved in the wildlife around them, that sparks that interest. And it's just not with animals, it's also with science.
Tell us about one or two really positive experiences that you've had at your refuge with people, like people that have inspired you to, you know, keep doing your work.
I get a lot of affirmation from people that bring me animals. Most of them have done everything they could for this animal, and they're just so glad that there's somebody that can help them. I remember how that felt for me when there was nobody there to help me and I didn't know what I was doing. And trust me, I made every mistake there was possible until I became educated about wildlife. So being able to help people, that really helps me. And I've had some really amazing people get involved. I've had people bring me a squirrel and then become one of my best volunteers later on. And so that is tremendously gratifying. But also, I've been able to work with people to solve their wildlife issues. And so for me, that's very gratifying when somebody who is going to euthanize all of the raccoons living under their house, where I'm able to go out and work with them and to get the raccoons to move on their own. And that's very gratifying to me to be able to solve a problem. Most problems with wildlife have answers to them. You don't ever want to catch an animal and drive it somewhere else and release it because that's always a death sentence for that animal. Mm-hmm. So I try to get those animals to move on their own if they're a nuisance problem.
Okay, we're going to take a little break now, so don't go away. We're back, and you're listening to Voices for the Animals with host Ender Black and his guest Jackie Marsden.
Hello. Yeah, we're back with Jackie. And what about if you enlighten our audience about the legality of squirrels, what we call, well, where they're called Eastern gray squirrels. Tell us about that, the legal aspects in Oregon and Washington.
So in Oregon, it is illegal for wildlife rehabilitators to rehabilitate any Eastern gray squirrel, Eastern fox squirrel, the Virginia opossum, and the Eastern cottontail. All of these are considered to be invasive species, and they have to be euthanized on admittance to any wildlife center in Oregon. In Washington, we do not have that rule. In Washington, we as rehabilitators can accept these animals and care for them. It is part of it is that in Oregon, they want to make it illegal to release into the wild any invasive species. And on the surface, that sounds really good. But there really is a difference between an invasive predator and an invasive prey animal, especially an animal that is so important to our wildlife here, our native wildlife. And the other thing that I don't think people think about in that particular issue is that if we were successful and all of the non-native animals were just magically disappeared, we really wouldn't have a lot of urban squirrels because the native squirrels in Oregon, the western gray squirrel, for example, that's an old growth forest squirrel. And, you know, we're getting rid of a lot of that. And the pine squirrels, the red squirrel and the Douglas squirrel, they really don't like people because they store all their food in one place. And when we see a bunch of debris in our barbecue, we just, you know, empty it out and throw it out. And then we've taken away that animal's food source for the winter and it will starve to death. So, you know, these non-native animals really do allow us to have those relationships. They like people. They follow people. Whereas the native squirrels here in Oregon are really not fans of us.
We're blessed, yes. Honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. These animals really do like to be around people and give us that opportunity.
Yes. And, you know, as a citizen, I mean, my name is Ender, and I'm a volunteer at KBOO right here. I'm not a journalist. So as a citizen, as an American citizen, rules like the ones that you just said that Oregon has for non-native species are just straight up disgraceful and barbaric, and they actually make me angry. What are your thoughts on that, your opinion, your honest human citizen opinion, and steps that you, from your point as an expert and, you know, your level of expertise, steps that you're taking to change all of these disgraceful rules?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I understand why they have the rules that they have, because an invasive predator will decimate your native wildlife pretty quickly. And it is just easier to say, okay, we're just not going to allow any of them. But, you know, from a human perspective, I find it to be, as you say, disgraceful that it serves no purpose. Because if you look at what wildlife rehabilitators do, we care about the individual. And if I were to release into the wild, let's say 400 non-native squirrels, 75% of those squirrels are going to be dead in the first year of life, and only 1% of them will be around in 5 years because they are a prey species. And the bottom line is, I'm caring for that animal, I'm putting the investment in that animal, and it has zero impact on the native species. I don't get enough animals through my care to make any influence at all on the environment because these are, again, prey species. So it's an unnecessary law. And now that I have recently moved to Oregon and many of my sub-permittees are taking over the refuge, I hope to get involved in the laws here. I do know Rick Boatner, the invasive species coordinator with Fish and Wildlife, and I do wish to continue working with him to hopefully get better laws passed, but it's going to be a long process, but fortunately I have a lot of energy too. So, you know, it is something that is definitely on my mind. I've got to change the laws.
Yeah, and you are in a place where you have the expertise, the power, basically. You know, I mean, you run a mm-hmm. squirrel refuge. Mm-hmm. There's somebody with you know, the capacity to do that. That would be you.
Yeah,
your
well,
friends.
I know a lot about squirrels and yeah. their behaviors, and I know why it does not harm the environment whatsoever for these animals to mm-hmm. be here. And if we can allow wildlife rehabilitators in Oregon on their own dime to care for these animals if they want to, that's just the humane thing to do. Because what's going to happen otherwise is people will do it themselves. And oftentimes they don't know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And these animals do suffer under the care of well-meaning people. And it's just unnecessary.
Yeah, squirrels. You know, I think about this often. We live in a city, we live in an urban environment, and so the alternatives that we have to watch wildlife are somewhat limited. Mm-hmm. Also, because we're human, so it's not like we're just going to approach a bear or a mountain lion because we don't have any defense mechanisms. But the way I see it, gosh, if we didn't have squirrels and pigeons and seagulls flying around and crows, then what are we going to be looking at?
You're absolutely yeah. right. Now pigeons are one of the, I mean, there are some non-native birds like...
No
like,
one likes pigeons. I dropped
the starling. It. Yeah, I mean, I am not a bird expert at all. Fortunately, we do live near the Audubon Society, mm-hmm. and they take care of that for me, so I don't mm-hmm. have to worry about birds. And you can transfer birds back and forth over state lines. Mm-hmm. You can't with mammals. Or you shouldn't.
What about if you walk us through your refuge? What does it look like?
Okay.
What is made out of? People working? Like, give us a tour.
Okay. So what I have are large outdoor enclosures, and off of the enclosures I have back at the facility in Vancouver, sort of 4x4x8 cubicles. And I do this so that if I get a squirrel in that needs to be separated from the larger population of squirrels, you know, I can do that. But the way that I release wildlife back in the wild and and it's a unique method and it works very well for their survival, is that when a baby comes into me, we add it to a sibling group of other babies, and it goes into foster care and it's bottle fed. And once they're weaned, that small little family group gets its own box. And once they're comfortable in the box, that box is hung in a really large area with other, you know, little family groups that we've kind of formed together. And then all of those squirrels grow up together and they're released as a community at a release site where we have feeding stations. Now, in the summer, this is not a huge issue, but in the wintertime, they need to have food out all throughout the winter because their moms aren't there to have buried food for them. So we've had very successful populations survive because they have this community to rely on. They're not just chased away. If you take a squirrel and you just stop at a park and let it go, it is going to die. It doesn't have food. The residents are going to chase it off. It has no housing, so it's really easy to get picked off by a bird of prey. And we take care of all that by providing the community, the housing, the food, everything they need to establish in a new location.
Do you see a similarity? I guess it's personal opinion, but based on your and all your experiences, do you see a similarity between how squirrel families are and how human families are, like squirrel moms, squirrel babies? Tell us about if there's something that people can feel like this familiarity with a squirrel.
Well, there are some similarities. There's a lot of differences. A squirrel only has three potential relationships, one with its mother, with its siblings, and its young. So if you have a young male squirrel who's an orphan, it doesn't have its mother anymore, and it's not going to have babies. So it's those sibling relationships. Those are the squirrels it's going to, play with and run around with on the trees. So by having all of these youngsters together, they're forming bonds and relationships that help them to survive. Boy squirrels and girl squirrels are not exactly having romantic relationships. It's a very fast interaction with a female, and she becomes pregnant. The male does not stay around at all. So, really the only relationship that I would say is analogous to human relationships is the mother and child and the sibling relationships. Those squirrels I have squirrels come in that are clearly very traumatized and very depressed acting. And I do have to take into account their mental state at having just lost their entire existence, their family and their siblings. And after a few days, they come out and they start playing with other squirrels and they do heal. But you can see that it is important to these animals that they do have, another baby to snuggle with. And
well, that's good enough answer for me. Just last question. Well, not question. I want to ask you to please tell our audience how they can help you and your work.
Mm-hmm.
Information on your website, your just tell us how can people help you with your work.
Okay. Well, my work is the care of the animals. And on a really hot day in the summer, leaving water out for these guys, that's an awesome thing to do right there. We are www.squirrelrefuge.org. And the more people that we can get involved in that volunteer network to help us either pick up or drop off squirrels, squirrels really don't need a lot. If you've got extra wood around, we can build boxes with it. So, go onto the website, see what those opportunities are.
Yeah, if you want to help out, www.squirrelrefuge.org.
Yes.
Squirrelrefuge.org, and you can help with this really heroic work that we need in the area. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Voices for the Animals on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. To hear a podcast of this program or any of our programs, go online to kboo.fm. And please remember to listen again on the fourth Monday of next month. Until then, remember that you too can be a voice for the animals.
And now, the KBOO News at Noon for Monday, November 27th,
2017. In local news, this Thursday, the Portland City Council will consider a resolution that could make I-5 and I-205 into toll roads at peak traffic times. The resolution directs the Portland Bureau of Transportation to develop, in conjunction with the Oregon Department of Transportation, a congestion pricing tolling plan for area highways. The goal would be to reduce peak traffic flows in the increasingly common gridlock faced by area commuters during rush hour. The requirement to consider tolling on Portland freeways to decrease congestion was part of a $5.3 billion transportation package passed by the 2017 Oregon Legislature. The legislature is prompted by a study that found traffic on regional roads grew four times faster than population growth. The committee formed between the Portland Bureau of Transportation and state highway officials will meet six times over the next year to develop the tolling plan. The Federal Highway Administration would have to approve the creation of any toll roads in Oregon, and the state hopes to have a plan submitted to the federal government by the end of 2018. In national news, environmentalists are in an uproar after it was discovered that the congressional bill overhauling the nation's tax code would open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil and gas drilling. The 19-million-acre wildlife refuge, located in northern Alaska, is the largest national wildlife refuge in the country. Attaching the proposal to the tax code legislation would mean only 51 votes would be needed to approve it, not the 60 votes most legislation requires. In environmental news, on Friday, the Mexican government announced plans to create North America's largest marine park and fisheries sanctuary southwest of the Baja Peninsula. The 50,000-square-mile sanctuary would prohibit fishing and natural resource extraction, including oil drilling and fracking, from within the sanctuary. Most commercial and tourist construction on the four islands within the sanctuary would also be banned. Last year, the United Nations declared the area to be a World Heritage Site, citing the large numbers of manta rays, whales, dolphins, sharks, and other large marine species that live in the area. Their nearby islands also provide critical habitat and nesting grounds for a large variety of protected and endangered seabirds. While natural resources